What's up, world? I'm your host, Angelica Beener, and this is Milestones, a podcast where my special guests and I take deep dive looks into landmark albums and anniversaries and events that are celebrating a milestone year. Welcome to episode 12 of season 2, and happy birthday to hip hop. Today is the 50th anniversary of this great art form. And in celebrating the birth of hip hop, we are honoring a man, a vision, and an artistic and cultural entity that is celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. It is only appropriate that these anniversaries go hand in hand when I think about the legacy created by my special guest, who I am beyond thrilled and honored to introduce to you for this incredibly special episode. Affectionately known around the world as Uncle Ralph, DJ, VJ, producer, director, journalist, documentarian, and Black media legend, Ralph McDaniels is the force behind his legendary and visionary music program, Video Music Box, which stands as the longest-running video program in music history. It ran for 16 years, bringing Black urban culture to our living rooms 6 days a week. This program was both innovative and revolutionary as it illuminated a budding genre called hip-hop and centered Black culture overall at a time when it was not a consideration in mainstream media. As a result, McDaniels helped catapult the careers of countless artists, often giving them their first opportunities and exposure. This is explored in the 2021 Showtime documentary, You're Watching Video Music Box, directed by none other than hip-hop icon Nas, taking us on that very journey. It features artists like Jay-Z, Sean Puffy Combs, Roxanne Shanté, Fat Joe, Mike Tyson, many others. He is currently the hip-hop coordinator for Queens Public Library. Please welcome Mr. Ralph McDaniels to the show.
Hey, Angelica. Thanks for having me.
Hey, thanks for being here. I'm so excited to have you here. You know, I have to tell you, 10 years ago, I was passing Mocada, the museum. They had a great exhibit up in honor of your 30th anniversary. So you were crossing the other way. And I had my shopping bags and stuff. And I was like, it blew my mind. And now we're sitting here. I'm such a fan.
Thank you so much. Yeah. You know, my good friend, Lori Combo, is the director of Mocada, amazing museum in Brooklyn. And she had a similar situation that you had, where a friend of mine lived across the street from her. And she said, as a kid, she used to watch me pull up in my car and get out. And she's like, that's the guy on TV. And so when she met, she was like, you have to come do something at my museum. I was like, you have a museum? She was like, yes. And so, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that she was affiliated with Mocada. Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, it was like seeing Michael Jackson or something. I'm telling you, you're that important to this music and to my generation and the whole thing. So again, it's an honor.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I love music. I was born in Brooklyn, and there's all types of music that's around us in Brooklyn, of course, Caribbean music. My family is from Trinidad and, you know, in the South. So I listen to Calypso music and soul music.
So with it being the 50th anniversary of hip hop, and Video Music Box is only 10 years younger than hip hop. I mean, that says a lot about how instrumental Video Music Box is to hip hop. Has that really sunk in for you?
Not really, because I can remember like it was yesterday, the first time, you know, I started hearing hip hop music in clubs or in the street, really in the street, because they didn't allow it to be played in clubs. The club owners were like, don't bring that hippity hop up in here, you know. And in the beginning, we did it in the park, as MC Shan says, we used to do it out in the park. And so the first time I started hearing breakbeats, which is really how it started off with the DJs, before rap records were even made, it was the DJ and the dancers. And people always ask me, what was that moment that you had when, you know, you were hooked by hip hop? And there was a point where all the dancers would hit the floor the B-boys and the B-girls, as we call it, and they would start spinning around and dancing. I was like, what just happened? What just happened? And why did they go hit the floor at that particular time? And and that was amazing. And I was hooked, you know, from there on.
Wow. You're talking about the break, probably,
yes.
Right? And you being a DJ yourself, is that what got you into DJing? Was it being in the park, witnessing all of that?
Yeah. But well, I come from before hip hop. So the first DJs I heard or I saw, well, the first person that influenced me with music was my uncle. He would come home and he would have vinyl and he would have 45 records and he would buy them in the store and he would come in and I would, he'd lay them on the table and I'd be like, can I open the bag? Cause see what you bought, you know? And he'd like, yeah, go ahead. And I just studied everything that was on that record, like who, where it was recorded, who was the producer, who wrote it, the artists, the studio, whatever was on that record was amazing to me. It just gave me a whole vision of what this came, this sound was, came from. And so I just was like, all right, I want to know more. And then we went to Reese Beach in Brooklyn and we saw a guy named DJ Flowers play, Grandmaster Flowers. And this is before hip hop.
Mm-hmm.
And he played danceable R&B soul records. And, you know, Teddy Pendergrass and Chaka Khan and Sly Stone and James Brown and that kind of stuff. And he played these records and the crowd went crazy and they started dancing. And I was like, I want to do that. I want to do that.
Yeah. You also have a really rich cultural history. You talked about your family being indigenous and also Caribbean. And then I was shocked to learn that your cousin is the legend, the legendary dancer, actor, Jeffrey Holder.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. That was something that, you know, we had a lot of art and a lot of culture in the family. And my grandmother's home in Bed-Stuy was the address given to people that came from Trinidad. Because when you came through customs, you had to have an address to where you were going. And my grandmother's address was the address. So everyone came. So it wasn't, you know, a surprise to see somebody came from Trinidad. They have their bags. They new to New York. They looking around. And we're like, okay, they just got here. And so,
yep.
You know, my grandmother would, you know, get a room for them to get themselves together. And eventually they would get their own place. And one of those people was Jeffrey. And Jeffrey, now he was, you know, a family member. That was my grandfather's brother's son. And so, you know, Jeffrey came and he immediately, you know, he had a background in dance and, you know, he was doing Alvin Ailey and Theater of Harlem and all of these things. He just came in and was already doing that because they had summoned him to come to the States to do this stuff. And he had friends and everybody, Jeffrey's like 6'8". And so everybody's tall like that, you know, that comes with it. And I'm like, what do they do? You know, and you know, I'm a kid. And so I'm watching this and I think that what gave me the bug to be in entertainment because everybody was so happy when he came. So I was like, I want y'all to be happy when I come. So I'm
right.
Gonna do something.
Oh, I love that. I mean, and that is how you are. You walk into a room, you light up a room. I mean, that's just the Uncle Ralph effect. The great MC, Roxanne Shanté, who is in your documentary, and you made your video directorial debut, which we'll get into. She said that when she was watching Video Music Box, she saw herself and she was talking about representation. And it's crazy that even in the 1980s, that was still something that we were really dealing with. You talked about not seeing representation in television as well as a kid. So can you talk to me a little bit about 1983? This is when you launch Video Music Box. You were working at WNYC. Well, let me back up just a little bit. What was your journey from, I guess, when you first got there to getting the show? And then I'd love if you could just sort of paint a picture for us of what 1983 looked like, because I think people don't have that right.
Yeah, well, you know, when I literally just graduated from college in 82. So I was there a year and I was watching these TV shows that we had on NYC TV, and we're like a secondary PBS station. So we had shows on the fire department, the police department, all these different things about the city. I was like, this is so boring. Who's watching this channel? And then one day I saw at the end of the show, it said public broadcasting. So I said, so this is supposed to be for the public. So how come we're not airing anything for the public that I live, where I live at in Brooklyn? You know, we would watch this channel put something on for us. And they were like, okay, we got a troublemaker here. I could see it in their face. But I wasn't trying to make trouble. I was just asking the question because I didn't know. I was an engineer at the time, and I didn't do production till that point. And then, you know, the streets of New York were like hip hop, reggae, house music starting to get a little thing going on. And all of these different sounds, the early 80s was the birth of a whole bunch of stuff. And you threw it on the wall and see what happened. So you could go to a club, you hear might hear Madonna, you might hear Michael Jackson, you might hear Bob Marley, you might hear Run DMC, you know, and that was okay, all in the same party, you know. And I said, I want to bring all of these music, all this music that I've been accumulating in my head all of these years, I want to put that on a show. Now, how am I going to do that? And one day these tapes came in and they had the Whispers and all these kind of R&B groups, which was also existed at that time too. And I said, oh, this would be cool on TV. People would want to see this. And the station was like, we don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, well, I'll compile it. And we put a compilation together of what would be Video Music Box. And they said, okay. And then they said, can you put it on every day? And I said, yeah. Which I, well, no, I, when I said it, I was like, I've never even done a program. I've never even produced a show before. And I didn't even have enough music videos to play for every day. I would have to repeat them over and over again. But that was the beginning. And it was really by word of mouth, people started stumbling across this UHF channel, which back in the days, we only had 15, 16 channels, and you had to go to the U. Then you had to make sure the antenna was right with the pliers, and then you had to move the antenna, and then get it right, and then it came in clear. Or you might have to tell your little brother, your little sister, just hold the antenna, don't move, stand there, and by word of mouth, people used to literally write, you know, because I at the end of the show it's like write us at One Center Street, da 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 da, and all these letters started coming in, and people just send me pages of requests that they wanted, some things they weren't even music videos for. And so they were enjoying the program, and the station was like, okay, you know, let's continue this. And you can you do it? And then you know, I started reaching out and getting more of the music videos, and kids ran home from school at 3:30 to watch Video Music Box.
Yes. You can count me among them. That's amazing. Because I think that people think that because the 80s was not so long ago, that, you know, there was this sort of utopia that we see now. But in 1983, and it's interesting because you have all of these shows that come along, Hot Tracks, Friday Night Videos, David Bowie does that now iconic interview where he takes MTV to task about a lack of representation on television. And we think about it, Michael Jackson had really kind of kicked the door in late 1983 with Thriller. So can you talk about some of that, like just how segregated that industry was at that time?
Yeah, no, I mean, TV, you know, was basically Italian and Irish. So we, as African Americans and Latinos, that was a renaissance for myself, Spike Lee, and others starting to get into this business. And NYC TV was like a stepping stone to go to the networks, to ABC, CBS, and NBC. And most people, you know, they worked there for about 6 months and they were trying to get a job at the networks, at the major networks. And that was the beginning of, you know, African, especially in engineering. There was a couple of African American and Latino executives, but not in engineering. And so yeah, so you got more people in engineering and in production. And you could every once in a while see a little light of our influence, you know, in the early 80s. It was clear. I always, when I look back, at some of my old video music box shows, I was like, it was clear to people, this is a black person who's making this show, right? And you know, and that's what I think Roxanne Shanté was talking about. You know, he's in the projects, he's in the back in the hallway, and he's doing an interview with this person who goes back there, you know.
Yes. You was out here. Yeah, but continue. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you know, I thought that was authentic to me. You know, I found that to be very interesting. I thought that was, you know, what hip hop wanted to see, or not even just hip hop. That was what people that were into the music, because it, at the end of the day, it was all about the music. Mm-hmm. And you just wanted to know who made those songs, because prior to that, you only had magazines like Right On magazine and all of these different, you know, pinup type magazines and Soul Train. And Soul Train was done in the West Coast. It was clearly that was in Hollywood that Don Cornelius was a big influence on me. Mm. And so was Dick Clark, American Bandstand. That was a big influence on me. And Casey Kasem show in the morning on Sunday mornings when I worked in my father's store. That's what we listened to. And he would be the top 20 or whatever it was. And I listened to these guys talk, and they talked about the artists and they talked about the music and where these people came from. And I was like, that's what people want to know. That was my reference. And, you know, so at least I have a video camera now, so I can take you to where they're from. You know, I can take you to Alphonse, I can take you to Brownsville, I can take you to Jersey City, I can take you to all these different places where you might not know about.
So, mm-hmm. Yeah. Cause that's what another thing, I mean, there's a laundry list of things that make the show revolutionary and iconic and so unique, which was, it wasn't just showing videos, but you were in the streets, as you said. You made it feel like what Black people had to say and how we lived and how we communicated was important. And we just didn't see that. But especially when we talk about urban culture and the urban youth culture at the time, that was really just kind of being born in real time. We can look back at the 50 years now, but at the time it being so new and putting a name and a face and a nuance and a feel to what we were listening to, that was brilliant.
I've said this before. When we used to watch the news, you'd be like, something happened. Somebody got shot. Somebody was killed on 125th Street or in Midtown. And we'd be like, oh, please don't let it be a Black person.
right. Yep.
And then, you know, the only time we saw young Black kids were young, especially men, were getting their heads pushed into a cop car. And I was like, I know we're doing more positive things than that. Why is that the only shot that makes it to the news? So I want to show other images of us doing things that I know I do and my friends do every day. So that was my mission. That was a conscious effort to show positive images of our people in the community.
Yeah, you talking to the youth and going into the prisons, but not just those things, like you said. I mean, you showed Black joy on television. And that's something that, like you said, we saw it on Soul Train, love Soul Train. But even there, it's in a studio, everyone knows they're there to dance. It's, you know, action, that kind of thing. I mean, there was nothing rehearsed about what you were, you know, you're in the club. We're seeing people dancing in real time. We're seeing, I mean, and speaking of which, as a result of you going out and doing this kind of work, we now have footage that, I mean, watching Nas and Biggie on stage together and a crowd just going wild, or the Wu or KRS-One, the Fugees, whoever it was. I mean, I was not old enough yet. I'm sure you hear that a lot. You know, we weren't old enough yet to be in the clubs, but you brought us in to experience joy.
Yeah, that amazing. Was amazing. Especially for the younger people who couldn't go to clubs like yourself at the time. Mm-hmm. So you might have been watching it and you're like, so that's what goes on in clubs. You know, those are the kind of dances that they would do. That's what kind of hat they're wearing or jeans they're wearing or whatever it was.
Exactly. Totally. Or the earrings, the big earrings, you know, the girls had all the cool hairdos and stuff. Wow, that's where I'm gonna be in 10 years or whatever it was. And I was. But I also want to ask you about the branding. I want to ask you about the theme song, and I want to ask you about the boombox. How did you come up with the logo and, of course, the iconic 5 Minutes of Funk as the theme song?
So 5 Minutes of Funk is a song by the rap group or hip hop group Houdini out of Brooklyn. I lived in Brooklyn at the time, so I was friends with the twins. The Ecstasy is a twin. He has another twin called Dynasty. And a lot of people don't know that. They would, you know, they'd show up and you'd be like, which one is it? So crazy. Ecstasy, rest in peace to Ecstasy from Houdini and Jahlil and them. I knew them, you know, and they recorded their music in the UK because they were signed to a label that was based in the UK. Actually, the label was based in South Africa. It was at the time we weren't doing work with South Africa. So it was questionable if we should be buying those records because they were a South African based company called Zamba. But we knew them. We were like, all right, they get a pass. It's hip hop, you know? And, you know, I went to the store and this record came out. One of the first songs they released, it wasn't released in the US yet. It was just released in the UK. And it had 5 Minutes of Funk on, I think it was both sides, 5 Minutes of Funk. It was an instrumental and a vocal side and a vinyl. This is vinyl back in the day. And I was like, this sounds like a theme song, you know? And I was like, what am I going to use for the theme song? And I was like, I got this song. And it just sounded to me when I watched all these kind of detective type shows, it sounded like something was going to happen, you know? I was like, it's 5 Minutes of Funk. Then something about to happen. This is it. This is a theme song. And I did, the crazy thing is that I just used it. I didn't get clearance to use it or nothing, you know? And because I knew the guys, I'm like, I know them.
It's right, gonna be right. Cool.
You know, forget about the fact that there's a whole record company that owns this song, right? And and so I used it. And the label thought, nobody knew. They thought I got the clearance from somebody, you know? And so they were like, yo, it's great. And so it was really promotion for that song. That song became the number one song for them based upon the fact I played the song every day, you know, as opening of my show. And Jahlil, who's really kind of the leader of the group, was like, man, that was when downloading came, that was one of our biggest downloads, 5 Minutes of Funk. He said, that's all because of you, Ralph. Mm. And I said, I thought it would have been Friends or Freaks Come Out at Night or one of them songs.
Right. Because like, nah, all on the same album.
Yes. And so, yeah, so that's how that came about. And then the boombox was because we all carried boomboxes in the 80s, in the early 80s. And we had like, we would change the boombox every once in a while on the show. They had two different boomboxes. And there was, you know, people said, well, why don't you call it Music Video Box? And I was like, no, because it's video first. It's about video. So we're going to do video music and then the box. And that's how we got the name.
Come on, one for the trouble, two for the banks, three for the ladies, four for the plate, 5 Minutes of Funk, this ain't no jump, so pull your bottom off the tree stump, ladies real pretty, city to city, but now we're getting down to the nitty gritty, from the bottom to the top, top to the bottom, I'm gonna rock them while I still got them, I'll rap and shower, has style and power, and this is our disco hour, I don't know if all of you have heard, so it's up to me to spread the word about the man that we feel has got to be real. I'm crown prince on the wheels of steel. He goes by the name of Grandmaster D. So if it's all right with you, it's all right with me. We're gonna rock you people's minds with ease, with some help from the maestro, if you please.
Yeah. Ah, and then the box that rocks.
Yeah, so the box that rocks, that came from the street. You know, that was like somebody said to me one day, I think we were in Washington Square Park, and because that was where all of the break dancers were, all of the, you know, the B-boys would be at, and a lot of people carrying their boxes in Washington Square Park. And somebody saw me say, oh, the box that rocks. And I was like, that's dope. We're going to keep that. And I started putting it on flyers. You know, it was like, watch Video Music Box 330. The box that rocks, and you know, we got artists starting to say it, you know, like Run DMC and Houdini and the Fat Boys would say, the box that rocks.
I love it. And then other things that made this show so groundbreaking and important, because once shows like Yo MTV Raps came along in 89. I mean, you had already, the wheels were greased. You were, let me ask you, is there a moment where you realize, oh, wow, I got something here? Was there a pivotal moment where you realized, wow, this is a thing?
I think that, you know, I tell the story as I was on a train. I lived in Flatbush at the time, and I was on a train going to Manhattan, and there were these guys, thugged out dudes. They on a train. It's only me and them on the train, maybe five of them. And at that time, you know, it could be a problem, something that you look at somebody wrong, anything could happen, right? So I'm trying to mind my business, and they looking at me, you know, like they're ready. You know, you could get jumped, I tell people. Mm-hmm. And it's true. And so I was like, all right, am I going to punk out and get off the train before I have to, get to my stop? Or am I just going to ride it out? So I rode it out. More people started getting on the train. The train got crowded. I said, nothing's going to happen. So just by the time I'm getting ready to get off at Center Street, where I was going to the station, One of them says, yo, man, yo, you the dude from TV? And I was like, yes. And yo, we like that, man. We like what you're doing, man. And right, exactly. And I was like, whoo. And I was like, why you ain't say that 10 stops ago, you know? But that was a sign that the streets were really checking for me then. And That's all I know, because I really was programming to that crowd, but I didn't know if they were watching. And that made me realize that they were watching.
Rapper stepping to me. They want to get some, but I'm the cane, so yo, you know the outcome. Another victory, they can't get with me. So pick a BC day, cause you're history. I'm the authentic poet to get lyrical. For you to beat me, it's gonna take a miracle. And stepping to me, yo, that's a wrong move. So what you on, Hobbs? Dope a dog food. Competition, I just devour. Like a pit bull against a chihuahua. Cause when it comes to being dope, hot damn, I got it good. Now let me tell you who I am. The B-I-G-D-A-D-D-Y-K-A-N-E. Dramatic, Asiatic, not like many. I'm different, so don't compare me to another. Cause they can't hang, word to the mother. At least not with the principle in this pedigree. So when I roll on your rappers, you better be ready to die because you're petty. You're just a butter knife, I'm a machete. This made by Ginsu, wait until when you try to front so I can chop into your body. Just because you try to be basing, Friday the 13th, I'ma play Jason. No type of joke, that game, puzzle, or riddle. The name is Big Daddy, yes, big, not little, so define it. Here's your walking papers, sign it, and take a walk as the Canes start to talk, cuz I'm the Big Daddy.
I think about some of the earliest videos I saw on Video Music Box. I think the one that's the most clear for me is Diamond D's Best Kept Secret. I you know, seeing something like that, or OPP. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing that on Video Music Box. I Got It Made, De La Soul, Pete Rock and CL Smooth. I mean, these were records that were big for us, but even when something like Yo MTV Raps came around, they weren't necessarily playing the stuff you were playing.
Well, Yo MTV Raps was really, I mean, it was needed because we needed a show nationally that could go across national. And that was, so it was great when it came on. But they had politics. You know, the record labels would say, we need you to play this one. And meanwhile, that's not the hit. I know what the hit is. The hit is this other B-side video that they made that they're not paying attention to. Mm-hmm. So that's not it. So I'm going to keep on playing my thing and turn up the rotation more on the one that they're not playing. Mm-hmm. And people will be like, I like the other song better, you know.
Mm-hmm. But let me ask you, because they came along 6 years later, and I think once you proved the viability of this Black art, the commercial viability, what happens for you when these bigger corporations start kind of closing in on you? Because you, like you said, this is a PBS affiliate, it's commercial free. You have a certain level of freedom and autonomy in controlling our narrative. But once it's catching on and it's getting into those other spaces, were they trying to encroach on what you had? How did you protect it? Because you survived all these shows, you outlived all these programs. How did you protect it when that started to happen?
I think at that time, we we went further underground. And that was always my thing. So let's give a shot to, like you say, a Diamond D, or let's give a shot to, you know, a Kool G Rap, who really didn't get played on the radio, but we knew within the circle of hip hop that he was really great. He's a great artist. And let's start doing stories when we're going out in the clubs, or if we're going out with a camera, on things that we know MTV won't do. We know they're not going to certain Black and Latino events in the city. We know that. They're not going to, they don't understand the correlation between dance hall and hip hop, you know, so we're going to do that. They don't understand the correlation between salsa or Afro-Cuban and the B-boys, you know, they don't know that, you know, or if they do, they're not doing that. It's just, that's going to scare away their core audience. And so we just started doing more of that. And people, the community wanted me to do more of that because that's where we really started. And so that's what we did. Now, financially, you know, it changes, you know, MTV was, you know, was a big deal. You know, they had a lot of money behind Yo MTV Raps. We didn't have anything behind us. And then even the artists were like, well, we're getting sales out of MTV. We got to go do this, Ralph. We can't do your joint, you know? And I'd be like, all right, no problem, you know, but don't forget where you started at, you know. So, you know, we had, you know, times like that where it's so not as bright as it was at one point, but we just go and we keep on moving because I'm stubborn like that. And I can't hate to lose. I'm not a loser. And so we're going to get some kind of win out of this. Something's going to happen.
That's right. But did you have situations where artists would say to the labels in terms of maybe promotion or marketing, like, yo, this is the plug. We have to do this. Did artists stand up and do that?
Yeah, no. Like Wu-Tang, when they first came, they were definitely 100% with us. KRS-One, still to this day, he's been amazing and still was like, Ralph, we here till the wheels fall off. You know, there were quite a few groups. You know, when you got into the 90s, which I say is Diddy era and Jay era, it was all about money. Mm-hmm. And they realized, that's when hip hop realized it had, or the artist had that much value. And Diddy says, we realized it, that wait a minute, we are pop right now and we can make a whole lot more money than we've been making. So let's stop, let's reassess this whole thing and start charging a whole lot more. And that's when hip hop really went into the mainstream of making the money that pop artists were making.
Mm-hmm. And even with that, you were light years ahead, though, because when I think about the sort of Diddy era of hip hop, this is where we have the crazy epic hip hop videos with the pyrotechnics and things like that. But you were even ahead of the game with that, because I think what a lot of people don't know, I didn't know before watching your documentary, that you actually directed some pretty iconic videos yourself, and you also were a producer on Juice. Can you talk to me about some of the producer directorial work that you did?
So yeah, so my partner and I, Lionel Martin, he was the vid kid on people who know from Video Music Box in the early days, and we started a production company because we would watch videos and be like, oh man, that wasn't what I thought the video would look like. You know, why didn't they shoot it in, you know, in Bed-Stuy? Why didn't he shoot it in, you know, in Times Square, you know? So we had ideas, right? Anyway, so we started working. First one we did was Roxanne Shanté, Roxanne's Revenge. And that was in the early 80s or mid 80s. And then we started doing Biz Markie. And Biz Markie, because they're connected, him and Shanté, and so Cold Chillin'. Mm-hmm. And I did all of the Biz Markie videos, not one, like Just a Friend, all of those videos. And yes,
what? Oh my gosh,
did all of those videos. I'll tell you a funny story. Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, there's a scene in the this is gonna be funny. There's a scene in Biz Markie video, Just a Friend, where he goes to visit his girlfriend at college.
Yep,
and Hakeem Jeffries went to that school, so he told me. that his and there's a scene where there's some brothers stepping. They're doing a I don't know what his fraternity is, but he was supposed to be in that scene and he had to go to work.
Are you?
And he was so upset that he couldn't be, and he saw it on Video Music. He said, "Oh man, that was my chance to be on Video Music Box."
Oh my gosh, that's amazing! And the congressman is also in the documentary, which is amazing as well.
Yes, I wanted to show how far, you know, we have come, you know, and knowing the importance of the message that Hakeem, you know, puts across the nation and him he's representing us, you know, when he goes and talks and he's voting and he's majority leader, you know, it's just, you know, it's super important, you know, that we have somebody in there that understands us. And he's a hip hop head to the T, you know, he'll tell you lyrics and the whole nine. He knows his stuff. But that was also, you know, part of why we wanted to do videos, because we thought that there were positive images all over this city, especially in New York. But we did videos outside of New York of our people doing things, and we wanted to put them in the music videos and hire Black directors and hire Black caterers and hire, you know, lighting folks that weren't getting work in Hollywood. But we were like, yo, man, we can't pay you Hollywood rate, but I got a couple of dollars, and those people were happy to work with us.
Yeah, yeah, they can do their craft and do their work. You provided those opportunities. Like you said, it goes so much further than we realize, you know, so much further than, you know, the joy of putting on the TV and watching the show. I mean, the community aspect, the social and cultural and economic impact that the show had. I mean, it can't be overstated.
I mean, you know, when you talk about Diddy, so my assistant or my intern at that time was Hype Williams. Hype Williams then goes on and becomes even bigger than us. And, you know, and I told Hype, I said, you are in charge of hiring folks, you know, take that responsibility, please, brother. And he did it for a while, but it came overwhelming. And he went to another company, which was totally white. And I was like, you know, I was like, well, oh, you just took a lot of money out of the hood, bro.
Yeah, man. Like,
right. And I was like, I know. I said, I get it. It was a lot to deal with. But that was the purpose when we first started. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then also you did It Ain't Hard to Tell from Illmatic, yes, right? You did Cream for Wu-Tang Clan as well. I mean, incredible, incredible stuff. I want to ask you a little bit about jazz, because there's this amazing clip in the documentary of you interviewing Dizzy Gillespie. And the whole documentary, I never saw Nas's eyes light up as much as they did when you guys were watching that clip. And you guys talked about Charlie Parker and all this stuff. Why was it important to you to have an interview with Dizzy on a show that's largely centering youth culture? Like, why was that important to you?
I wanted young people to know who he was, first of all, because he was important to me, and he's important to American culture and world culture. And growing up, my father used to play jazz, and I was a fan of jazz, you know, and jazz to me, well, Dizzy Gillespie says it, you know, I said, well, how did they treat you? He said, they treated us like crap when we first started doing jazz, you know, and he says the N-word, quote, N music. Mm-hmm. And that's when Nas made the face. And we, hip hop went through the same similar steps, you know, not just from outside of our community, in our community. You know, when we first took the records to WBLS, those radio stations didn't want to play it. And those were Black owned radio stations that they thought this is just a fad. This is not going to last. Don't come back in here with that record ever again. You know, there were clubs that, you know, were Black owned. We do not play hip hop records in here. If you play a hip hop record in here, you will be fired. And so you were stuck on both sides. So we just became our own culture by itself. And that's what has developed into what it is today.
Word that I'm man on fifth. less, and I don't jest, cause the words I manifest, they will take you, sedate you, and I will stress upon you the need for you all to feed your minds and souls, so you can lead yourself to peace. I got a real objective here. I am effective here, cause I select a clear method.
Wow, 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 wow. That's deep. I never really thought about it like that. I guess they assumed that there was a certain element that would come with that, yeah. Or fighting, yeah. Or stuff, I mean, like that.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, we didn't help, but it was, you know, it was you. You know, it was you. You know, come on. I don't care what you, if it's, you know, Black kids, Asian kids, Latino kids, white kids, you name it, it's you.
That's
and it's
right.
Gonna be, you know, and so it happens everywhere, but you know, the spotlight was on young Black men, and you know, they didn't want that, you know. So I got it. You know, it still happens to this day when we go to fill out insurance information. You know, like, what is hip hop? Oh, the whole language changes. You know, like, why? You know, what's the difference? So it still exists in America.
Mm-hmm. You talked about going deeper when you wanted to continue to distinguish yourself from, you know, maybe what other people were trying to copy, I'm just say it, or replicate on the national level. And you talked about going more underground. But at the time, underground was people like Jay-Z, which is crazy. I mean, but we tend to, you know, especially the younger generation, it's like, oh, Jay-Z and Beyonce, or the billionaire Jay-Z, you know. But not only was he not mainstream, he was underground. I think of Jay-Z the same way I would think of a Big L or a Boot Camp Clicker, you know, underground. Where do you think your musical instincts come from? What is it that you see in an artist?
Well, you know, first it's like, if they don't have a record out, you know, you're kind of checking out their vibe, you know. And Jay-Z, I saw him before he had records out, and because he was hanging out with artists that I knew. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know if he was writing for some of those artists, but he was partially what he was doing. And so he had a little swag with him. You know, he had that Brooklyn thing with him. And then when I saw him get on stage, he had something. So, you know, something was going to come. So we're like, when are we getting the record? Same thing as Nas. You know, you heard about Nas, you know, Chip Too Smile, you know, Camouflage, Queensbridge is tough, you know, and, you know, okay, so what is he talking about? And then when you heard the sonics of the song, you know, both of them, I was like, oh, this is it, you know, and there was no question in my mind, you know, by the time he drops Ain't No with Foxy Brown on it and Dead Presidents, Jay-Z, I'm like, this dude got it. He's touching people, you know, mm-hmm. And so... And that goes for others, you know, like Lil' Kim changed the game. She was just, the mouth was like a guy, a sailor, you know. I was like, what did she just say? You can't say that. She's like, why not? I can say whatever I want to say. And that opened up the doors for what we have today, you know. Mm-hmm. And that was empowering to a lot of young women who might have been in bad situations and domestic violence, or just didn't have the self-esteem. She gave them the motivation to step forward. Yeah.
I'm Mama, Miss Ivana. Usually rock the Prada, sometimes Gabbana. Sticky for your creamy and your riches. Zsa Zsa Gabor, Demi Moore, Prince Diana, and all them rich misses. Puff Daddy pumped the Hummer for the summer. I follow in the E-class with the goggles. 96 model, bad click on a stroll.
Tell them how we go.
Cruise control, nothing make a woman feel better than Berettas and Amarettas, but the leathers and mad cheddars. Chilling in the bins with my amigos. Trying to stick a brother for his pesos. If you say so, then I'm the same chick that you wanna get with. And lick me where it's hot. Gotta hit the spot. If not, don't test the poom poom. 99, Panani Dani.
I think it's fascinating that you had that point of view, you know, being Uncle Ralph, the cool uncle. You had maybe 10 years on these people, or maybe not as much, but you know, you were the big brother in the room. You know what I mean? Were your parents cool with it? How did they feel about what you were doing? Because, you know, my parents were born in the 30s and 40s. And when hip hop came around, you know, Salt and Pepper Tramp, she'd be like, that's Otis Redding. It's like, Mom, we know it's Otis Redding. It's okay. It's okay. So did you get, as a person of, you know, Gen X like me, did your parents, were they like, you doing that hip hop stuff?
No, not really. No, you know, I don't think that my mom or I don't even think they even understood what was going on. They just knew I was on TV, and that was a good thing, you know. And as far as the music side of it, they probably were like, well, you know, it is what it is, you know. But I'll tell you a story about my mom. My mom calls me one day. She works for Housing Urban Development. And she says, look, I have this kid here. He says he sells T-shirts. So I said, OK, he wants to meet you. Well, actually, he wanted you to do an interview. And she very rarely asked me something like that. So I said, all right, no problem. So what day can they come over? So I said, tell them to come on Thursday. So they come, and it's four guys, and they sit down. And I'm like, all right, so what's the name of the clothing line? And they said, FUBU. And I was like, OK. Where can we get it? And it was like, well, we have it on Jamaica Avenue in Queens. And, you know, and I said, all right. So then I was like, this is amazing. FUBU, what does it mean? And they were like, for us, by us. I was like, what? This is the most amazing thing I ever heard in my life. And I put the interview on TV, and they said they started getting phone calls of people who wanted to get the shirts and artists. So, you know, Damon at the time was like, Diddy called me, but I don't know how to get in contact with him. I said, all right, I'll tell you where to go see him. And all of a sudden, they started getting placement in videos, and their stuff started being, you know, known. But that was only because my mother called me and said, I got this kid who's not Damon, but Keith, who works with FUBU, worked with my mother. And that's how it happened.
Oh my gosh. Uncle Ralph, you are at the center of so many things. People look at Damon John, they look like Shark Tank and the mogul that he is today. But you gave him and his partners their break.
It was so many things. That's the thing about hip hop and its movement is that there's so many different places where people have played a role in moving the culture forward. So we saw opportunities. Damon was smart enough to know, this is a great opportunity. I've got to do the right thing and really develop this brand and partner up with people that can help me move forward. And as he did that, he would say, hey, Ralph, you know, I got this going on. You know, you want to be part of it. You want to help out? Come on through. And we did. And me and him are still friends to this day. And the rest of the guys as well, you know, they all have gone off and doing their own thing, but they still have FUBU licensed in the whole world. You know, crazy. And they still make money, you know? And so, yeah, it's you know, we learning in real time, you know, we didn't know, you know, some of these things. And I still things that I don't know, and which is fine. And, you know, we're learning it in real time. Yeah.
Can you tell me about the reach of the program in terms of who could access that UHF channel? And then, because I don't know if it was just New York or if it was Tri-State, but Video Music Box became coast to coast, up, down, east, west, north, south. Everyone knew about the show. And we're talking pre-internet. There's no streaming. There's no on-demand. So what was the exact reach of the program? And then how did it become this thing where everyone knew that this was the place to be?
So the broadcast range of the station was the New York Tri-State area. I'd say that on the show, big up to the New York Tri-State area, New York, Connecticut, New Jersey. And so it would go almost to Pennsylvania, South Jersey, in New Jersey. And in Connecticut, it might go to mid-Connecticut, and then to New York and Long Island. And that was just if you're watching it on your UHF, the broadcast version of it. Now, in that time, this is before cable, when we first started, you had satellite. So we would upload it on satellite. So stations had the option if they wanted to take it or not. I didn't know who was taking it. So we started getting letters from Chicago and Detroit and Virginia. So I assumed that the only way they got it was because they were taking it off the satellite, and they were, because they were watching it at a particular time, because they were letters. And so that's how people got it in the United States. So people on the West Coast know nothing about video music, but other than when they come here and they watch it and they go, we don't have that in LA, or we don't have that in Oakland, you know, and the same thing for, you know, other areas like Atlanta and other places. Then we started finding out that we're getting a buzz in places like Germany and Italy and the UK. How are they getting it? So it started off with those VHS tapes. The VHS tapes were how you recorded stuff off of TV back then. It's like a cassette, but it's a video cassette. And people would record 4 hours of video a week. You could record 5 hours, really. You could record up to 6 hours on those tapes, but the long extended play. And they would take it, and especially servicemen would be going from country to country, and they would sell them like they sold mixtapes in those countries. And so that's how people began to see it overseas.
Wow. That's dope. Wow. That definitely was.
Yeah. No, I didn't know in the beginning either, like, how are they getting it? And we realized people had a whole business going on, some of these young guys and girls.
Yep, because I was recording it too. I was recording it on the VCR. Oh, that makes sense.
That's how they found out. How they found out. And it took me a minute, because I was like, I don't know. What's y'all selling my show somewhere else that I don't know about?
Right, exactly. Keeping up with all of that too. You know, I got to ask you about the shout out, because I feel like it's very important for our listeners to know, because we say that today. Everybody says it today. I want to give a shout out, you know, to this one and that one. We need to know where that started. It's important.
So people say that I'm the one who started. I don't know. I just started saying it. And I went to clubs, and we'd be in the clubs. And this is like 85. We first started shooting, because we didn't shoot live till 85. We were on, but you just heard me talking. It was a voiceover. 85 is really when I started going to clubs, and I started doing this thing called shout out. Nobody, I had never heard the word shout out before that. And everybody's like, Ralph, you started it. Then they said, oh no, Red Alert started it. Then somebody else said they started it. So I was like, I don't know, but I know it's hip hop, and I know that I hear the president shouting out his wife. I hear everybody saying that word on a regular basis. So if I started it, or if it started in hip hop, it's a hip hop term. That was not a term that general public said.
Yes.
It's a hip hop word.
That's right. People need to know that, because it's just co-opted, and everybody thinks, you know, it came out of thin air. Nothing comes out of thin air. Nothing comes out of thin air.
And I'm tired of the playing our culture down, or just in general, not just in hip hop. Like, come on, are you kidding me? So many things that we do, it's American culture. Stop playing yourself. This is not just Black culture. Stop it.
That's right. Exactly. Exactly. Giuliani, who, you know, is so inextricably tied to 45. But for those of us, we have a different level of trauma with Giuliani, because he was our mayor. And he shut down WNYC TV. Was it 1994?
98.
And it was sold?
Well, it was sold to a big cable company, but they never did anything with it. It just sat there dormant. Mm-hmm. And the license, the, you know, FCC license, just was never sold. They didn't do anything with it. So it sat there forever. And then about 5 or 6 years later, WNYC-TV, which was another city TV station, but it was a board education channel, came in and opted in on that license. And that's how we have NYE today. It's really NYC-TV. It's the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So talk to me about you're recalibrating. What was that like? And who supported you? Obviously, we didn't get to talk about it, but, you know, shout out VidKid and Lionel and your beautiful wife and daughter and all of your wonderful supports. But how did you recalibrate and who sort of helped you once that happened? Because that had to feel like the rug being pulled from under you.
Yeah, because we were, you know, we were hot. We were in them streets and in them clubs and we was dancing and all of a sudden, the power was off. And we're like, what? For real? And nobody, the general public doesn't understand. It's just like it was just gone. Like, I don't see it no more. And so they took y'all off. And I'm like, well, they took the whole channel off. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I went to NYE TV and I started talking to them. And they were like, yeah, we'll try it out. They act like they know who I was. I was like, y'all know who I am. Stop playing me, man. And so, you know, eventually it took a lot of kissing butt to get it over there because I was just like, I got to get it back on the air. Even though this channel doesn't have the range that we had in the last channel, we just got to get it back on the air. So we got it back on the air. And, you know, when they that's when they put us on late night. And I was like, can we get it a little earlier in the daytime? They were like, nah, keep that hip hop late at night. And so that's where we've been from there. We're still on right now. This is 40 years of Video Music Box. And you know, and I meet people. I was out this weekend and I met this couple from Jersey and they were like, we VCR it, you know, every Saturday night. We watch you. I'm like, beautiful. So there are folks that have been watching since the 90s, since the 80s. Some young people that are 15 are tuning on because they can't go outside on Saturday nights. And they're zipping through the channels and all of a sudden this thing comes on with music and they're just learning about it now.
That is so cool. You know, I want to ask you about, speaking of the sort of legacy of it, you have, is it somewhere upwards of 30,000 hours of archival footage? I want you to talk to me about the project that you have going on to digitize all of this, because I feel like for me, you're like the musical version of Like It Is. And when that went away, I think about it all the time. The late, great Gil Noble, shout out to Gil Noble. Yes. You know, I wonder where all of that stuff is, what's going to happen to it. And so I understand that you have an archival project that you're working on, and I'd love for you to tell our listeners how they can support that.
So I started the Video Music Box collection, which is over 30,000 hours of video content that we've either shot or that we've acquired, and we needed to digitize it. We needed to make it into a digital file that people could look at eventually in some type of learning situation. And I said, look, let's create this so kids 50 years from now can know that this was the narrative, not the narrative that somebody just made up. This is the real narrative, you know? And so when the pandemic started is when we really, because I had time and I was like, I'm going to really, really focus on this. And we started digitizing. And the digitizing is one part of it, but it's done in real time because so if something is an hour, it takes an hour to digitize it. The hard part, which is really the work of archivists and people that do this work, is identifying everything that's on that tape, meaning where were you at? What year was this? Who are the people that were there? Anything and anything, what were they wearing? You know, all of that information we're putting into a database that people can able to draw from it, and it will be part of our history and Video Music Box history, as well as hip hop's history. And you'll be able to have access to it and look at it and find out things. You know, like you said, you saw Biggie and Nas, and nobody really knows that story unless the people that were there that night, you know, and Method Man was there, and Young Common was there, and Fat Joe was there, and OC and all these people were there. And Nas tells the story. And I said, what are we, you guys kept saying, the Goodfellas, what was that? He said, we were going to make an album called The Goodfellas. It was me and Big. Ooh. And so, right.
Mind blown. I mean, and Nas directed the 2021 Showtime documentary. For everyone who's listening, you have to see this documentary. It's on demand now. You can still watch it.
It's on planes. My friend told me he watched it on JetBlue the other day.
Okay, JetBlue. Come on, JetBlue. Yeah, and is it true that Nas went from producer to director? He was like, wait a minute, I got to direct this. Is that...
Yeah, no, that's a fact. Yeah, because he was originally a producer and he's part of the ownership of Mass Appeal, which is who ended up producing it. And I was like, I wasn't crazy about the director that we had at the time. And we were just, you know, trying to figure it out. And then they said, well, Nas wants to do it. And I was like, Nas don't have time to do this. He's doing being Nas, you know, he don't have time. He's like, no, he wants to talk to us. All right, let's talk. So he got on the phone and he's like, yo, I was like, yo, bro, this is my life. This is my family. Do not play with me right now. He says, oh, I'm not playing. I'm dead serious, Ralph. I want to do it. So I said, I'm blessed. Thank you. So thank you, sir.
And that was it. Oh, my God. Isn't it crazy how it's full circle? You directed his debut, and now he's directing your documentary.
Yeah. It's crazy because, you know, I was in the house with Nas and his mom when his mom was alive, you know, shooting all this stuff, and his brother. So we've known each other really well for a very long time. And to watch the progression of who he's become is amazing, you know? Mm-hmm. And I call him my little big brother, you know, because he's, you know, clearly he's been super successful in the business. But he's, you know, I know him as a kid. So, you know, what am I supposed to do?
Exactly. Exactly. And so just to swing back to your archival project, there's a website where people can actually help raise, because this is no small feat, what you're trying to do here.
Yeah, no, it costs millions of dollars to do this. And they're doing it at a high end and they do it correctly, like, you know, the Schomburg and the Smithsonian and those type of institutions. So we're doing the same work that they're doing locally here in New York. The website is videomusicboxcollection.org. videomusicboxcollection.org, and you can give to support us. It's super important that we get this work done while we're still here. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of us remember all of these tales and stories, because someday it's going to be 50 years from today and nobody was there that was in these videos. So we want to make sure we get that information correct right now.
That is so beautiful. 50 years later, I think that now you're, you know, I mean, you always have, but, you know, you're really getting the flowers and things like that. But how do you identify your place in hip hop for yourself?
That's a good question. I think for me, it's the uncle. You have to have somebody in the business that is going to look out for your best interest. And I never tried to take advantage of anybody. I try to give people the right advice, even if, you know, I couldn't help them personally. I try to say, you know, put them in the right direction. If it was Jay-Z, if it was Nas, if it was Run DMC, if it was, you know, Buckshot or Black Moon, you know, whoever it was. And in the culture, in the village, we have to have people that are there for not for monetary reasons, just to make sure that the culture goes in the right direction. And sometimes my friends will be, man, you care too much about this. They don't care about you like that. But that's just the way I am. I really love the music and I love my people. So, and my name, Ralph, I was somewhere and it said helper. And that's what I guess my calling is just to help people out.
Wow. Job well done. Congratulations on 40 years of Video Music Box, all the incredible work that you have done for decades, the lives that you have changed, the culture that you have shifted and pushed forward. I am so grateful to you. And thank you so much for coming on my podcast. We definitely know that website, and we could definitely go there as often as possible to make sure that the preservation of this culture and this treasure chest that no one else in the world, literally no one else in the world has but you, is preserved for centuries to come. Uncle Ralph, Ralph McDaniels, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for a great interview. You know, it's always good when you talk to people that are knowledgeable of the music or love the music as well as love the culture. And I can hear that in your voice when you first started talking. So thank you.
Oh, that's an honor. Thank you so much. Milestones with Angelica Beener is a production of WBGO Studios. This episode is co-produced by Steve Ann Smith. Theme music by Riley Glassford. Listen on your smart speaker by saying, "Play Milestones, celebrating the culture." And if you're enjoying this content, please be sure to subscribe and review on Apple Podcasts. Check out the rest of WBGO's podcast lineup at wbgo.org/studio.